Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, helping businesses to hire workers with disabilities. Information about the benefits of hiring people with a wide range of disabilities is available at abletrust.org or 850-224-4493. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Halfway to the state Supreme Court's deadline for a new Florida congressional map, a consensus seems no closer. As it turns out, that's nothing new.
Yeah, we've had numerous examples of the court getting involved in redistricting in Florida.
Also tonight, charter schools across the South are starting to eye traditional school revenues for more income.
I think we're now at a point you have to make a decision. Reinstitute a moratorium on charters or you bleed them to death.
We'll also hear about recent staff arrests in Florida prisons and the debate over whether proposed prison reforms help make those arrests possible. And an international terrorism expert visits Tallahassee. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. Politicians and activists are taking the fight for Florida's congressional borders to court again. Nick Evans reports the courts are weighing whether to take over or leave the next draft in the hands of lawmakers.
With Florida's congressional borders still in limbo and the parties to the case still at odds, in fact more divided than they've ever been, it's getting pretty easy to meet every negative development with a, so what else is new? But most probably don't realize just how right they are.
Yeah, we've had numerous examples of the courts getting involved in redistricting in Florida, several quite significant.
This is Aubrey Jewett, a political scientist at the University of Central Florida.
But yeah, so 62, 72, 92, 2002, and now we have had court intervention either at the federal or state level or in some cases both.
And it's not just Florida having problems. In the most recent round of reapportionment, courts have altered congressional maps in 9 different states. That failure rate has some, like Democratic Representative Evan Jenny, calling for an independent redistricting commission.
It's become very obvious to anyone paying any attention whatsoever that the folks on one floor above us cannot do this. They just can't do this.
But barring some pretty drastic changes in state government, there's virtually no chance of that kind of measure catching on in the legislature. Despite the bitterness and distrust that exists between Republican majorities in Florida's House and Senate, they absolutely agree reapportionment is their prerogative.
Whereas Section 4, Article 1 of the Constitution of the United States provides that the times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislator thereof.
This is Representative Mike Hill, a Republican from Pensacola. He argues, like many Republicans, that the Supreme Court ruling violates the separation of powers principle. But his suggestion to reject the court's ruling garnered support from only a handful in his party. Instead, after grumbling about the burden of Florida's Fair Districts Amendment, majorities in the House and Senate approved a map, just not the same one as the other chamber. Ironically, Jewett says the push for that amendment began as a plan for a redistricting commission.
Their first attempt to get a constitutional amendment on the ballot was to have a bipartisan commission draw the lines. They actually gathered signatures for that, and they gathered enough to trigger Florida Supreme Court review.
Jewett explains the court tossed the amendment because it violated the single subject provision and the ballot summary was misleading. But if Florida wants a commission, whether independent, nonpartisan, or bipartisan, the road runs through the ballot box, and there are no active measures to that effect. As it stands now, the borders are back in the justices' hands. The House wants 60 more days so all parties can submit proposals at the circuit court level. What's more, they want the court to acknowledge the map is only provisional, and lawmakers can revise the lines at will. The Senate still wants to bargain, submitting a map that recedes from some but not all of its agreed-upon changes. But the voting rights groups that brought the case say the legislature struck out, and the Supreme Court is on deck. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Florida has about 650 charter schools. They're part of school districts, but are privately managed and largely free of many of the rules governing their traditional public school companions. But as enrollment in charters has increased, so has the financial cost. Lynn Hatter reports Tennessee and Georgia are also struggling to find ways to support their charter school movement as well.
I'm going to ask you to convince me to get on your side.
In Gadsden County, Florida, one of the lowest performing districts in the state, sits Crossroads Academy Charter School. Crossroads has won national praise as a Blue Ribbon School of Excellence, but it didn't start out that way. Principal Kevin Forehand says it's been an evolution.
It actually evolved from an alternative program. When the charter school law came out in 1996, we picked it up in 1997. I don't want to say we had to shave the alternative image, but we had to become more than just an alternative school.
Crossroads has survived, going from the school of last resort to first choice. Yet for every three charter schools that succeeds, one fails. Florida has a 30% charter school failure rate, and a big part of that is financial. Adam Miller, leader of Florida's School Choice Office, defends the number of closed schools and the method of counting them.
It includes schools that merge. It includes schools that never actually opened. It was a school that gets a number. There is some context that's important. For example, if you look at that state database, there's also, I think, 1,200 traditional public schools that show up as closed as well.
I think we're now at a point you have to make a decision. Reinstitute a moratorium on charters or you bleed them to death.
Charter school lobbyist Jim Horn wants the State Board of Education to support more funding for charter schools. He's a former Florida Education Commissioner. Charters have historically received less funding than their traditional school counterparts, and that's largely due to a disparity in school construction and maintenance dollars. During the past few years, charters have gotten the bulk of the state-based funding for those projects. But Robert Weissert, vice president of research for the think tank Florida Tax Watch, points out it's not enough.
Whether it's the state money that's coming out or the local money, it's all taxpayer money funding public schools. And so we need to find a distribution that's fair for the students.
The charter school lobby is once again eyeing local school district tax dollars to make up the difference. Some districts share that money with charters while others don't. It's a similar story in Tennessee, where less than 100 charters have managed to open and only a handful have closed. Tennessee Charter School Center Policy Director Emily Lilly credits that slow and steady approach with Tennessee's low closure rate, but she notes that could soon start to change. Tennessee is also home to the Achievement School District, which oversees the conversion of low-performing traditional public schools into charters.
We actually passed a piece of legislation last year that everyone kind of colloquially referred to as the Default Closure Act, which says that if a charter school appears on the state's priority list, which is the bottom 5% that's kind of eligible for ASD takeover, then that charter school would be automatically closed. And
that list comes out in 2017. Meanwhile, Georgia, Florida's northern neighbor, has 118 charter schools. Louis Erste, director of the Georgia Department of Education, says the state has been picky when it comes to who can operate a charter.
We make it moderately difficult to get a charter because we want to make sure that you actually, can do a good job before we risk, any educational ill for any children that might attend your school.
Georgia has launched a commission on school funding to address the financial disparities. And Tennessee is also looking at ways to close the gap, doing like Florida and focusing in on those local school district dollars for maintenance and construction. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Still to come on Capitol Report, we'll hear several weigh in on whether recent arrests of correctional officers are proof of new prison reform policies.
We're certainly taking aggressive action to ensure that all uses of force by our officers are appropriate and that, again, that they're using the least amount of force necessary.
An international terrorism expert thinks the way to get rid of groups like ISIS is to sic the armed forces of the region's Arab nations on them.
Most of their armies have been trained by us.
Country weddings, U-picket operations, Halloween festivals, skydiving? Farmers are turning to so-called agritourism for extra cash, and local governments are worried.
A lot of people have never been to Florida. They come out and they're just astounded, at how pretty it is and so on and so forth. So it's public relations.
And as temperatures drop, some worry migrating birds could bring the North's bird flu epidemic with them. But others say, with a little thought to safety, it's not likely.
So while everybody should be cautious, I'm hopeful it's not going to be the poultry apocalypse of 2015.
In the past few months, there have been a slew of arrests of Florida correctional officers, three just this week alone. As Sasha Cordner reports, many have dealt with gassing inmates, and state officials say it's finding these so-called bad apples proof of recently implemented prison reform policies.
Judy Thompson, president of a group called Forgotten Majority, has worked with the Florida Department of Corrections to help address some of the problems within the prison system, plagued by inmate deaths, allegations of abuse by prison guards, and cover-ups. Thompson says she gets many letters from inmates claiming they were abused within DOC, and that includes inappropriate use of chemical agents. They're used to discipline inmates. And Thompson says when they're used, those incidents are supposed to be recorded.
I mean, that just doesn't always happen. I'm going to tell you something that happened at Northwest Florida Reception Center Christmas Eve. We had officers that went through those corridors and gave a little spray of chemical agent to the inmates in those cells and said, Merry Christmas. And I got the letters for that. Wish them a Merry Christmas.
It's an area that came up during this past legislative session with regard to prison reform and an issue surrounding use of force. DOC Secretary Julie Jones says she gets the most questions about. Monitoring the use of chemical agents was put into a comprehensive prison reform package that ultimately died during the budget impasse between the House and Senate. But following the end of the legislative session, Governor Rick Scott issued two executive orders.
We obviously take any use of force incident extremely seriously. We want to ensure that all uses of force are the least amount of force needed to ensure the safety of our staff and inmates, and that also the force was used appropriately.
One executive order did include tracking excessive use of force cases and monitoring the use of chemical agents on inmates. And DOC spokesman McKinley Lewis says the prison agency has been taking aggressive actions.
We obviously take any use of force incident extremely seriously. We want to ensure that all uses of force are the least amount of force needed to ensure the safety of our staff and inmates, and that also the force was used appropriately.
Since Scott's executive order took effect, eight correctional officers across the state have been arrested, two of them facing federal charges for physically assaulting an inmate without justification. Last month, a Lake City correctional officer was arrested for lying about gassing an inmate in the face. Most recently, two other arrests occurred, which included two Suwannee correctional officers charged with battering two inmates by spraying them with chemical agents and also falsely reporting it.
So we have a use of force unit within our Office of Inspector General who reviews all uses of force that occur within the agency statewide. And we also have challenged our institutional leadership to review uses of force and to keep an eye out for things that maybe look a little suspect so that they can take the appropriate action. And, you know, if it raises an eyebrow, it's probably better to refer it to the Office of Inspector General for a review and then have nothing, you know, have it come out that it was appropriate than to ignore it and then have it turn out that it wasn't.
Baker Republican Senator Greg Evers, who chaired the Senate Criminal Justice Committee, was in charge of this year's effort to reform Florida's prisons in the Senate. He calls the arrest proof things are turning around.
Well, I think that what you're seeing is advance notice of the bill that we tried to put through last year that the governor ultimately did some work on through executive order, and the secretary implemented some of the rules. So I think this is what you're seeing from that evidence that we had collected back during session last year to where you're seeing the actual benefit of it now.
But Forgotten Majority's Judy Thompson disagrees.
Personally, I think nothing's changed, but it's the seat that I sit in. You know, I'm the one that receives all of the reports of abuse and maltreatment and medical neglect. So even without the legislative session, there would still be some officers that would be found out and would be fired. That happened before the legislative session. But we're talking about going below the tip of the iceberg. That's not happening.
She says instead there should be what she calls a, quote, atypical approach to put some penalties in place.
One of the parts of the Senate bill was to weigh those cans of chemical agent going and coming on a daily basis. If that was adopted, then this gentleman that I just sent the information about to central office, they would know that that chemical agent was used because his can weighed 0.5 ounces when he went to work, but when he came out, it was 0.3.
During this past legislative session, DOC Secretary Jones did say they do have those, quote, checks and balances in place, but Thompson says they definitely did not have it in place as far as last year's incident with the spraying of the inmates mentioned earlier during Christmas Eve. Meanwhile, Thompson, who's worked with DOC secretaries in the past, is hoping to open a dialogue with Jones, even sending her a report Friday outlining more abuses Thompson says she's learned about within the prison system. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kortner.
Outside of its universities, and despite a surprisingly diverse population when it comes to national origins, Tallahassee doesn't focus on international politics the way some other towns do. The constant hum of state government and all the intrigue that realm generates tends to overshadow what's going on in the rest of the world. But sometimes a real international expert comes to town and the locals pay attention. That's what happened today when highly respected global terrorism and Middle East expert Dr. Waleed Faris spoke before the Capitol Tiger Bay Club.
Yes, I am a analyst at Fox News, but let me remind you, and you could see it in Wikipedia as well, I was an analyst with MSNBC, and that is very rare to happen. I can be, and I am, on Al Jazeera, and I'm on Al Arabiya, and many Al's in the region. So that gives me the ability to actually think and be able to put together the information coming from many parts and try to have my own at the end.
The Capitol Tiger Bay Club, in case you don't know, consists largely of the capital city's preeminent movers and shakers from both public and private sectors. When it comes to international terrorism, Dr. Faris told the group that there is widespread agreement on the terror group called ISIS.
It's one of the very few areas of consensus in Washington and in Brussels and in many capitals in the Arab world and the Middle East, including Russia. We have so many problems with Russia, but yet on ISIS, this is the only subject probably in the world where we all have consensus.
Where that consensus breaks down, Faris explained, is in the United States, particularly in Washington, D.C.
Because in our debate in America, ISIS is a problem for others, yes. But it is expanding, and soon to be, it's going to be a problem for everybody in the international community.
What to do about ISIS? Some American politicians want to see U.S. troops lead the charge against it. But Faris thinks the feeling among every Arab nation is that ISIS poses a threat to them, so it's those Arab countries that should be doing the military heavy lifting.
The Arab countries such as Saudi, UAE, Bahrain, Kuwait, but mostly also Jordan, and eventually Egypt, these countries, most of their armies have been trained by us. Some of these countries we have actually helped. Egypt, we've helped. Jordan, we've helped. The others have bought from us. So the bottom line is there is a block of Arab countries. They should be doing the job.
That's in the short term. In the longer view, Faris says the fight must use ideas and education instead of bullets and rocket-propelled grenades. He's urging those Arab nations to spread the message of an alternative future for the region's young people that does not include blowing up oneself and chopping the heads off infidels. Finally, Faris addressed the raging debate over the Obama administration's deal with the Iranians. Faris conceded that agreement seems to be tilted in the Iranians' favor and does not guarantee they won't keep coveting nuclear weapons. However, he thinks the deal isn't really with the Iran of today, but the Iran of tomorrow.
Look at the future of Iran and invest in it now. See what happened in Egypt, see what happened in Tunisia, see what's happening in the world of internet. And of course, it needs a vision. It needs that you have the right NGOs. Bottom line, I would invest in the Iranian people.
People that Faris believes are actually in the majority today and will one day assume control of the country from the Ayatollahs and Islamic hardliners. The Tiger Bay speech by Dr. Waleed Faris was certainly a big change from the usual kind of talk heard around the Capitol, which more often than not is focused on such things as, who's likely to be the next state Senate president. Instead of selling out to developers, more Florida farmers are turning to so-called agritourism to save their traditional way of life. As Jim Ash reports, things like country weddings, U-picket operations, and Halloween festivals are saving the day. But local governments are concerned.
Marty Higginbotham's thriving country wedding business is a staple crop of his agritourism industry. With guests coming from as far as Europe and California, Higginbotham says he's doing more than just keep his farm afloat.
It's a real public relations coup for the state of Florida, is what it amounts to. A lot of people have never been to Florida. They'll come out and they're just astounded, you know, at how pretty it is and so on and so forth. So it's public relations.
And according to the State Department of Agriculture, keeping farmland would help bust a trend. Florida's 10 million acres of agriculture are a million fewer than 2003. An acre is about the size of a football field. So the Florida Agritourism Association sprang up to help farmers like Higginbotham cultivate the trend. It's growing.
Some of them have events on their property throughout the year. Farm to table is probably one of the most popular ones, when you can basically have a meal from the food that's been harvested on that land.
Now, some farmers like Higginbotham don't think a 2013 law deregulating agritourism goes far enough. He says local fire inspectors want him to upgrade an open-air structure he uses for weddings on rainy days. Republican Representative Neil Comby of Polk County is fighting back. He's filing legislation next year that prevents local governments from enforcing existing agritourism ordinances.
Yeah, we thought about trying to even put more definition on that, but everybody seems to think that, you know, cultural is cultural, and weddings are certainly cultural events.
But not everybody agrees everything that happens on a farm is agritourism because it happens on a farm. The Florida League of Cities' David Cruz worries that the agritourism bill will tempt lawmakers to break a compromise they reached with local governments 2 years ago.
If we were to see this bill go through the process and amendments pop up that would open the door for weddings on land just because it's agricultural, and preempting our zoning laws, we would definitely have concern with that.
Cruz has reason to worry about reopening the 2013 law. A Northwest Florida legislator tried last year to stretch the agritourism definition to include skydiving. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
And what came as a surprise to many folks in Tallahassee, including more than a few at lottery headquarters, Governor Rick Scott today appointed Tom Delisenseri as the interim secretary of the Florida Lottery. This followed the resignation of Cynthia O'Connell, who the governor said recently announced her October 1st departure to explore opportunities in the private sector. A few remarked O'Connell's announcement must have been very recent because the lottery website still had her picture and bio on the secretary's page as late as this afternoon. Usually the new person's information is up at the same time the governor's office makes the announcement. O'Connell was among Scott's first appointments when he took over as governor in 2011. Tom Delisenseri has been the deputy secretary of sales and marketing at the Florida Lottery since 2013. Prior to that, he served as the director of sales for the lottery and began his career there in 2000 as a district manager in Fort Myers. You're listening to Capital Report on Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally, tonight, as birds fly south for the winter, some are worried they could bring avian influenza with them. It crippled the poultry industry in the Midwest, but Regan McCarthy reports experts say it's not likely to be such a concern in Florida.
Florida is full of major flyways for migrating birds.
There's big flocks of red knots on the beaches of the peninsula, and you know, piping plovers have been back in the panhandle since June. We're seeing yellow warblers moving through now.
That's Audubon Florida's Julie Rathmel. She says the fall and winter in Florida can be a bird spotter's paradise. But this year, the Florida Department of Agriculture is worried migrating birds might bring more with them than just binocular-toting birders. Jen Meal is the department's spokeswoman. She says Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam is concerned about the avian bird flu.
Typically, this disease can be spread by birds as they migrate through the flyways, which does happen as the cooler weather months approach.
But Meal points out the bird flu poses very little risk to humans and adds there are no confirmed bird cases in Florida now. And Wraith Mill says Florida's climate could help keep it that way.
Florida is fortunate that we're warm. So one thing about the flu is, it's transmitted often in droppings from waterfowl, but it doesn't persist in the environment when it's warm. So it starts degrading at about 65 degrees Fahrenheit. And when you get up to about 85 degrees, it's toast.
And Wraith Mill points out migration has been underway for several months, and there haven't been any cases. Wraith Mill says there's no reason anyone should hesitate to enjoy the season's birds, but she adds those who keep animals, such as chickens, might want to use a little more caution and pay attention to cleanliness. And with a $400 million industry to worry about, Mill says the Department of Agriculture is encouraging the same. She says those with backyard flocks have a responsibility.
One of the key parts that a Floridian who has a backyard flock can play is to monitor their birds.
Meal says any birds that look ill should be reported to either the U.S. Department of Agriculture or the Division of Animal Industry.
$4 there. Thank you very much.
Meanwhile, at a Tallahassee farmers market, Meredith Leedy, who operates Herbs and Eggs Organics, has heard about the outbreak in other parts of the country, but says she isn't worried.
People have built up immune systems and live a healthier lifestyle. I know that our birds live a healthier lifestyle than most of them out there in the industry. So just knowing that gives me confidence.
Leedy says she has more than 400 chickens, but is familiar with each of them and can monitor their health every day. And the story is pretty similar across the market.
We have a lot of poultry of different varieties. We have turkeys, guinea fowl, ducks, and geese.
Ron and Annie Layton own the Little Eden Heirloom Farm in Crawfordville. They're paying attention to what the migration could bring, but also say they have healthy birds they monitor each day. And they add the wild birds who fly by don't tend to get mixed in with their domestic bunch. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Our regular Capital Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, and Regan McCarthy. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capital Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPRCapReport, and hope you'll join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capital Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capital Report online, including archives of past shows, at fprn.org. Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, helping donors make a difference through planned giving, putting donations to work so people with disabilities can too. On the web at abletrust.org. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.